Coming up next, it's the Media Project. I'm Rex Smith. I'm here with Judy Patrick, Barbara Lombardo, and Ian Pickus talking about what's going on in the news media. We'll talk about those right-wing media figures and what they're saying about Kamala Harris. We'll talk about the appetite for more news as the Harris, Biden, and Trump news cycle is leaving us thirsty for more. And we'll talk about the succession battle in the Murdoch Empire and what that might mean for all of us. That and more is coming up in the Media Project next.
They wallow in corruption. Papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and
Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis on what's going on in American newsrooms, at least some local ones, and an insight into how newsroom decision-making is done. I'm Rex Smith of the Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union. I am here with my colleagues, Ian Pickus, the news director of Northeast Public Radio here.
Ahoy, hoy.
Oh, yes, indeed. Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette, vice president of the New York Press Association.
Ahoy, matey.
And Barbara Lombardo, what is your linguistic...
Well, this is a lot of pressure. Anchors away.
Whatever that is. Was that supposed to be pirate talk?
Arrgh, matey.
Barbara Lombardo, formerly editor, executive editor of the Saratoga and
They made
and the
me
Record
do
of
that.
Troy. They made you do it. There you go. So we are grateful to have you with us. We had a time when we look back on a consequential period, looking back over the 10 days or so since folks last heard us on these airwaves. We've had a president drop out of the race for re-election. We've had a vice president ascend into dominance, clearly becoming the standard bearer for the party. And that followed, of course, the week before that, where there was an assassination attempt. And the week before that, where there was a debate that kind of knocked a president out of the race. So it is a consequential time for news. And I think the question that overrides all of this, and that a lot of what we're going to talk about today probably falls into that, is the role of the media in presenting what people see versus digging out what they may see. Ian, maybe you can talk about this to start us off. There's a lot of talk, it seems to me, about media creating the news here, that it was the elite news media who chased Joe Biden out of the race. True?
This is my first show since both of those incidents happened, and I'll just take a second to point out what happens when breaking news happens on the weekend. You know, most reporters dropped everything. I literally burned food that I was cooking to get something going on the Trump shooting. And we heard a lot from listeners about both Biden's condition and the assassination attempt. And because I'm the one who gets a lot of those messages here at the station, I'm a little salty, as the kids would say, about some of the things I heard. One, about the Trump assassination, we had a number of people prodding us to air conspiracy theories that it was a setup, that in some way Trump had orchestrated this to look stronger and better in his reelection. Just speculation, and for anyone who's ever looked at, you know, what happened with JFK, not entirely new speculation, of course, but really taking us to task for not getting those ideas put on the air immediately. And what we have to do, and it's the same thing with Biden's condition, is follow the facts and see what the experts are saying, see what the FBI Director Wray is testifying about, instead of rushing on the air and saying, boy, he survived, it only got his ear, and there's perfect photos of it, so that has to be a setup. with respect to President Biden's condition. I heard a lot of listeners of this program, too, complaining that WAMC was in some way hectoring the president, or by focusing on his poor debate performance, kind of seeding the clouds for him to be pushed out of the race. And what we do in the station is try to call balls and strikes as we see them. If members of Congress from the Northeast, people we cover on a daily basis, make an announcement that they think the president should step aside, we're going to cover that. We don't have a stake in the outcome here. At least on paper, we don't. Maybe with respect to press freedom, we do. But we don't have a dog in the fight. WAMC is not on a side of any of the candidates. And to blame the station for pointing out what we all saw, which was that President Biden's debate performance was shockingly bad and he didn't seem like he had his fastball anymore. If we didn't say that, because in this sort of conversation we might prefer a different outcome, we'd be doing a terrible disservice. You know,
it almost sounds, Judy, as though what people are saying then, to Ian's point, is that they kind of want us to be C-SPAN and just let stuff be out there and not offer any analysis or insight or make any choices about what we air and what we don't.
You're right. And we call that stenography. And that's not what we want reporters to do when they go to a city council meeting, when they cover a presidential debate. You see what you see and then you report it. And clearly, the debacle that was the president's debate performance needed follow-up. And we are people who live in communities, and we heard our neighbors and our friends talk about the debate performance, and it was clear there was something happening, and journalists followed it up. And as the cascade of concern mounted, and as the polls started to come in that showed clearly that there was something undermining this president's candidacy, that needed to be reported. You know, one of the things about summer in the news business, it used to be a really slow time. And even in presidential years, you would see candidates going to fairs and to, you know, looking at butter sculptures. And it was kind of slow, but it has come at us so fast and furious that we've gotten addicted to fast and furious. And one of the things I've noticed, especially with cable news media and also maybe with print journalists, is this need to speculate and to think about the next thing. Within minutes, we have Kamala Harris saying that she's going to run and we have the president endorsing her. We need to speculate about who the vice president is going to be. Like, can we stop for a minute and talk about the news that actually has happened in the last 30 seconds before we move on and start speculating about the next thing?
So, Barbara, what about this topic that people are criticizing the media in terms of, in effect, saying, yes, we chased Joe Biden out by spotlighting his debate performance, but not enough was said about Donald Trump's debate performance, which was his usual pantheon of lies?
Well, I appreciate hearing criticism, because if people aren't contacting us and complaining, that means they don't care what we say. And that is when you really have to start worrying. That when nobody's mad at you, then you've done something wrong or you're in danger. But I think that is a baseless, groundless, inaccurate observation of saying that it was the media that hounded him out. We reported what we needed to report. And I have felt from the get-go of that debate that more needs to be said each time about, you know, while Donald Trump spewed lie after lie, Biden couldn't complete a cogent sentence, sort of like I'm having a trouble with right this moment. But the emphasis of that event was Biden's apparent inability to continue in office. And then we just covered that.
It was the news of the event, because Donald Trump's lying is not news as much. Interestingly, there's a terrific column in the New York Times by Steve Rattner, who actually began his career as a newspaper reporter, including at the Times, and became chief advisor to the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. He's a financier. And he went through the Trump lies, actually, and just very cogently took it apart. And I wonder if in the months to come, as there will no longer be the question about Biden's capacity as a part of the storyline, since he's not running, if there will be more attention, because maybe what Trump says and doesn't say, maybe his stumbling will become more newsworthy, because there is only a certain amount of time to cover an event. And maybe that becomes what is the big event when there are debates, for example.
And also, let's look at this from a PR perspective. You know, two things can be true at once, and I think we experienced that. You know, Trump got up there and said a lot of wild things, like he has done for 10 years, that were not true. At the same time, the White House had a credibility gap of its own. Since the Jack Herr special counsel report, we heard that Biden's really sharp, but we didn't see him do a lot of interviews. We saw him do almost no press conferences. And so when he finally had a chance to be in center stage and blew it, and it leaked halfway through the debate that, oh, he had a cold and, oh, he had jet lag from 2 weeks ago, and he had one bad night, he's going to turn it around in these interviews, and then the interviews weren't spectacular either. I think two things are true at once, and it's not questionable now that the White House has sought to limit the damage of Biden's apparent decline in recent months. So you have to do both as reporters. You can't pull a punch and say that Trump said a bunch of crazy things and take the White House at its word when it was clearly covering up to some degree.
I would agree with you on that. I think we also have to be careful. One thing I think you mentioned, Ian, was that we in the media or here at the station or generally all of us as journalists, we are not on the side of a candidate. And that's a tricky, sticky situation. In our reporting and our coverage, we definitely don't want to come across as being on one side of a candidate. But taking the presidential elections as an example, when the past president explicitly says that the media is the enemy of the American people, that's not going to be your best friend. So you still have to cover, but you're covering it with the lens of somebody who is concerned about free press, you know, free democracy. So
how do you report something that is potentially racist and denigrating? For example, there are a lot of people in the right-wing media, people on Fox News, who are referring to Kamala Harris as the DEI candidate. You know, if I had had a job applicant come into my office at the Times Union, a person of color, and I would say to the HR officer, oh, that's a DEI candidate, ooh, that would have been cause appropriately for discipline. I had a reporter who denigrated her black colleague, saying, well, she just got that beat because she's black. And I put a letter in her file, a disciplinary letter, appropriately. But there's no such discipline. This, in fact, is a line of attack that you're going to hear in the right-wing media all the time. And we have to cover it, right? We need to cover the media's coverage when it goes to that kind of an issue.
Yes, but things like, yes, it's disgusting to say she's a DEI candidate. It's ridiculous. It should be a talking point that the Democratic side could then use against the Republicans. But we know in our own newsrooms and in a very white community like Saratoga, when I would try to hire people of color, it was difficult. We didn't get a lot of applications, people of color. At one of our owners at the time, when Gannett owned us, they were really trying to make, I thought, an admirable push to increase our numbers. So I would be on the lookout for clues on resumes. So if somebody was involved in a college organization that maybe hinted that they might be a person of color, I was extra interested in that position. I wouldn't hire somebody who wasn't qualified, for sure.
I think we're going to have to brace ourselves because we're going to see a lot of this in the coming months. I would have thought we'd gone past this, but the Republicans seem to have no shame in just coming out with racist, sexist, homophobic things that I never thought a politician seeking public office in this country would say. You know, in some respects, at least they're being open about it, and I know that they're racist, and they're not being subtle at all. But how do you? I mean, I think maybe it's time for the media to start having some serious conversations and try to educate people about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and how we got to where we are, and why it's important that we look at things differently than we have for the last 200 years.
And one more thing about this, because I think it resonates to something we talked about earlier. When President Trump was wounded in the assassination attempt, there were calls to tone down the rhetoric. You know, a lot of people were quick to blame the rhetoric, not knowing what kind of motivation the shooter may have had or not had. So I would just challenge everyone to look at what the rhetoric has been from the people who are calling on others to tone down their rhetoric, because typically you'll find hypocrisy.
Yes. You know, we are now so eager, since we've had these interesting news events that have really elevated the attention of the public to what's going on in the political realm in a season when frequently there is a hiatus. I think we're going to actually see more attention to what's going on. It's an opportunity for the news media to show its capacity for us to actually deliver on some of these stories, because the public is probably actually thirsty for information now, and it's our responsibility to define who these candidates are, to let people know more about Kamala Harris, about J.D. Vance, about people that we haven't seen, and about whoever emerges as the vice presidential candidate, which certainly by the time this airs, we will know. So let me ask you all about an interesting question that is raised. Joe Biden goes on the air to make a speech from the Oval Office, only the fourth of his presidency, in which he talks about he's giving up the job and makes essentially a patriotic speech, but also endorses his vice president. And Donald Trump, in advance of that primetime address, demands in letters to ABC, NBC, and CBS that he be given equal airtime. There is no longer a fairness doctrine that the FCC used to have that would require something like that. But if you were a news executive, well, Ian, you're a news executive. Here you are. You're running this news operation. Do you think that that's a valid request on his part?
From the perspective of Trump 2024, I do not think it's a valid request. I think in the times that I've been contacted by candidates who have heard an opponent in their race on our airwaves seeking equal time, we've almost always said yes. Not even getting into lawyers or what the FCC might think about it. Typically, our answer has been, yeah, you know, if we spoke to X candidate for 20 minutes and we're going to give you the same 20 minutes, even if you don't have a chance to win the race, because it's the right thing to do. For Trump, it's a little rich. That was not a political speech by Biden, let's be honest. He did not mention Trump's name. He did not campaign for Kamala Harris within the context of that speech. And this from a candidate who a couple of days earlier was complaining that Fox News deigned to interview the governor of Minnesota because it makes Trump have to play defense in that state. So give me a break.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
You know, I'm with you on that one, for sure.
And it's not as though Donald Trump doesn't get a lot of airtime. I mean, the final night of the convention, when he gave his speech, which many people considered a meandering yawner, still, he had 25 million viewers. So that is a significant amount of time. And that was judged to be a news event, even though there wasn't really anything too terribly newsworthy about the Republican Party nominating Donald Trump or about anything he said.
Right. And you can argue that the world already knew that Biden wasn't running. So was it news that he was making a speech about it? Well, yeah, still, it's the first official speech by the president of the United States about his political future.
And we're at a time where, because of the questions about his condition, you know, there's some value in seeing him sit down and do the speech, I think, and how he can get through it. He just had COVID. No one's seen him in a week.
While he was giving the speech, I was at the Earth, Wind & Fire and Chicago concert at SPAC, where people who were of Trump's and Biden's ages did a great show.
That's weird.
No jet lag.
But I watched it this, so I was able to watch it this morning.
Yeah, well, you watch Mick Jagger parading around on the stage still. Of course, he actually eats and exercises more than Donald Trump. From our letters, from our listeners, Larry writes, the U.S. media often repeats worries about U.S. deficits and tax income shortfalls, but almost never talks about where the money goes. The Republicans' media machine teaches our less smart fellow citizens that it's wasted on benefits for immigrants, welfare moms, and forgiving college loans. So what is the government spending on protecting Trump's rallies? How much to Trump hotels? How much have we spent killing 40,000 Palestinians, destroying the infrastructure built by European donors? Are there smarter uses for the cost of defense? What's the cost of our pretended need to have enemies? So I think the point that Larry is making here is that he is alleging that the media doesn't do a good job of explaining the nuts and bolts of where we're spending money, and we allow the talking points about deficits and tax increases and immigrants to be what carries the day.
I think he's got a point. I think he's got a point. Also, it's really hard to do well. I mean, you're talking about numbers that the average person cannot conceptualize in a realistic way. You know, the federal budget is humongous. The debt and the deficit are two different things. And if your lawmaker is celebrating a, you know, $100,000 grant that they got for some community organization, you know, that might be a headline, but it has nothing to do with the big number.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about big numbers in budgets and hard to explain to people where all that money goes.
And when it is explained, and I think that there are places in the media where you can find that information, you as a consumer have to work harder to dig it up yourself if you wanted to find it.
As a former reporter, there was nothing I love more than digging into a budget. And a budget is both a revenue and a spending side. I hate it when they refer to budgets as spending plans because they're revenue plans as well. But it's the detail. It's concrete information that really makes a budget story sing. And there are such big numbers and so many projects. It is hard. I'm sure a full-time publication could churn out tons of copy every hour of every day just trying to explore this federal budget.
And there are specialized publications that do that. There are, of course, places that look at every detailed note of every kind of spending on both the state and the federal level. But consumers don't find those and don't really want to read those. We could fill our columns with it in newspapers. You could fill your airtime talking about it, but you wouldn't draw an audience.
And it's different. The federal government doesn't work like your local city mayor, where they have to make both sides add up, where they have a huge problem, or even the state budget, which is always late, but it's a number and you can break down the number year over year. The federal government operates without a budget plan in place. It was one of the big fights of this Biden administration.
And it still is, by the way. Congress went into August recess without passing the appropriations bills that are necessary to fund the government. So when they come back in September, the House will immediately have to pick up some continuing resolutions because the Republican conference is divided and they can't pass the appropriations bills.
That reminds me of a little pet peeve when the Congress people go home and they take credit for bringing home funding that they did not support. Then I think it behooves the media, all of the media outlets involved in those stories, have a phrase in there saying which she voted against.
Yes, and I think you're seeing more of that in Northern New York of late.
Yes, indeed. Northern New York, Northeastern New York, that would be, yeah. Thank you, by the way, for that thoughtful comment from Larry. Here's another letter. Thank you from Debbie, who points out a line from a New York Post article. Speaking of the presidential race, instead, Trump is likely to face someone 2 decades younger than him. 2 decades younger than he is. Debbie raises the point, I know there are no copy editors anymore, but I guess I'm foolish enough to think that someone who gets hired by the Washington Post or the New York Times knows the most basic rules. It's really a shame. I'm sorry, it is not the New York Post. That is the Washington Post. Someone 2 decades younger than him, rather than he is, I think is the proper grammar there. Hmm? So good point. Thank you. Appreciate that, Debbie. If you're interested in making a comment, media@wamc.org is how you get through to us. And we're always happy. media@wamc.org. And today we also want to take a note of a little reporting in the New York Times, which is just a little bit too fun to pass up. And that is the real life succession battle. The Times, through some significant investigative reporting by Jonathan Mahler and Jim Rutenberg, points out to the secret battle for the future of the Murdoch empire. Rupert Murdoch is trying to change what is called an irrevocable trust. Irrevocable, a word meaning you can't change it. However, he is trying to draw back the irrevocable trust that had his empire upon his demise divided among his four oldest kids. Instead, he's trying to take out three of them, James, Elizabeth, and Prudence, and make sure that his empire goes into the hands of the one conservative right-wing offspring, Lachlan, who is now the CEO. Interesting. Murdoch is 93. It just sounds an awful lot like...
I wish we could play the music of the Succession theme song.
Which is probably the only thing from that show we could possibly play on the station.
What was interesting here is the logic of it. Rupert Murdoch's logic is the brand is more valuable if it's in Lachlan's hand because he is going to keep it conservative. So the reason they do what they do is all about money. I guess we've known that, haven't we?
Shocking. Shocking, I tell you.
I'm rooting for the other three.
Yeah. It is telling that he really believes that the future of the company is tied to maintaining a political point of view. Who's to say that at a future time there wouldn't be a financial viability to a different point of view?
That's the big question there. Is he interested in maintaining the viability of the company for that particular point of view? How important is the point of view as opposed to just keeping the company thriving?
He
can never have too many billions.
He wants to rule from the grave.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating thing. And I suppose people who haven't watched Succession can still get it on the Wayback Machine or something, right?
Right. Streaming on Max. But it's very similar to a plotline in the last season or so where the scion of the Roy family decides that his cable network has to go hard right to pull off the final deal or something like that. I forget most of the details, but it's... Yeah, they had their finger on something here with Murdoch. And when these Murdoch battles will ever end, I mean, it's amazing. I feel like I've been reading about the succession plan for 15 years already.
And not to wish any family, you know, not to get joy out of the unhappiness of families, I did have fun reading that story.
And Ian, who are you rooting for?
Yeah.
I'm team cousin Greg. I think it's time he got even with Tom.
All right, inside. Finally, folks, local news, local political news. A new study, thanks to Northwestern University, examines how Americans get news about local government and politics, surveying 5,000 adults. And get this, 68% say they often or sometimes get local news about government and politics. And that beats out economy, schools, sports. I wonder if people are telling us the truth. I get the feeling that the attention that people pay to local government and politics is actually diminished, that we are actually at a point where Americans are turning away from coverage of local news. Am I wrong about that? Do you think?
No, you're not wrong. You're not wrong.
How do you know he's not wrong?
Because I know what they click on.
Yeah.
And the Plattsburgh Common Council meeting that decides whether they're going to change their form of government is probably more important to the average resident of Plattsburgh than whatever Trump said that afternoon. But they're not clicking on it.
Yeah. There is one interesting bit of information that comes from this, that one of the professors who ran this study in Northwestern makes the point that when it comes to local political news, there is a relatively low level of polarization, that there's virtually no difference between Republicans and Democrats in terms of how often they get their political news and how satisfied they are with the quality of it.
Which, Judy, I'm interested in hearing your take on it as a vice president of an organization that deals with a lot of small newspapers around the state.
Right. And well, it's fascinating to me what they may or may not consider local news. I mean, are we talking about village or are we talking about your local assembly person? How local do you have to be? I'm heartened that they at least think they care about local news or in local government and local politics. It's one thing that the local newspapers still do or still can do, but do they do an exhaustive analysis back and forth of where a candidate stands? Often they give them a forum, but how closely they track every place has diminished as the size of their staffs have.
And it's really the issues that people like to follow locally.
Yeah. So. All good. All right. We are out of time. That has to be it for this week. Here we've had the Media Project with Ian Pickus, Judy Patrick, and Barbara Lombardo. And we're grateful to our producer, David Sina, and to you folks for joining us this week. I'm Rex Smith. We hope you come back again next week for the Media Project.
Actors upon a living stage now. Newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage, ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper gill.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.